Hello and welcome Behind the Marquee, the podcast where we talk about movies and what's going on in our art house community in downtown Ann Arbor. My name is Nick Alderink and I'm the programming and media coordinator with the Michigan State Theater. Today I have another interview for you. What you're about to hear is my conversation with Joe Gantz, director of The Race to Save the World, a documentary now playing in our virtual movie palace. As you will hear, Joe is a longtime activist as well as an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker for Taxi Cab Confessions, and we had a great talk about his film. The documentary focuses on the personal lives of climate change activists and their fight to correct damages that are being done to our planet, no matter the legal cost. And the people in this film are incredibly inspiring, and Joe himself is a very insightful individual. So I hope you enjoyed this talk that we had. Without further ado, here's my conversation with director Joe Gantz. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Nick.
It's great to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So is that the theater behind you?
It's an image of the theater, but that's what our main theater looks like. It's a background.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's a 1,700 seat auditorium.
Good God. It's amazing. You're in Ann Arbor?
I am in Ann Arbor. I was just about to ask, have you ever made your way down this way?
Oh, yeah. My first girlfriend was in Ann Arbor.
Oh, really?
And I was a senior in high school, and she was a senior in high school, and we had met over the summer. So we would drive 4 hours each way to see each other.
Oh, yeah.
And so I spent quite a bit of time in Ann Arbor. Nice, beautiful city.
Oh, isn't it? Whereabouts are you from?
I'm from Cincinnati originally, but I've lived in California for a very long time.
Gotcha. So before we talk about your film, because this is a podcast from an art house theater, I would just want to ask, like, what cinemas you visited as you were, you know, being informed as a filmmaker?
Say that again. What I did?
Like, did you have any, like, local cinemas in Cincinnati that you loved to visit?
Well, of course we had cinema, but
yeah.
I feel like I'm like a storyteller.
Yeah.
And so it's storytelling. I don't love film in the sense I think that film and television are mainly crappy. I made quite a bit of television. I started out doing a lot of documentary television, including yeah. Taxi Cab Confessions, and it predated reality television.
Yeah.
And so in the early years of us making my brother and I making television together, we were pretty much left alone to do what we did. And then as reality television came on the scene, which I consider to be the opposite of documentary, they wanted me to do that. And I resisted and resisted and resisted. And then finally, about 10 years ago, I decided I wasn't going to do any more television. I was only going to do social action documentary. And I think that, most of the television in this country and a lot of the film is just it's just noise, and it's it doesn't inspire or really tell a meaningful story. A lot mm-hmm. of it. So I'm not a big fan.
So what was your own history with activism, and what inspired you to start joining these causes?
Well, I'm 66. I was growing up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I had just gotten my license to drive. And I heard about a protest for the Vietnam War in Washington, D.C., where they said, if the government won't stop the war, we'll stop the government. Uh-huh. And that sounded pretty interesting to me. And I asked my parents if I could go. And they said, are you crazy? You've just learned how to drive. You probably barely know how to drive. It's maybe, a 8-10 hour drive to Washington, D.C. Of course you can't go. And it's dangerous to go to a protest. Who knows what that entails? Of course you can't go. So I stole the car and went and spent the weekend there with my friend Rick Michelson. And then we came back. And that was my first real protest.
Oh, very cool. Well, did you personally know these activists? How did you find the people involved in your film, The Race to Save the World?
Well, I say that in documentary filmmaking, there's three rules to documentary filmmaking, and they are casting, casting, and casting. So it's hugely important, you know, who you find. I started this film, it took me 6 years to make this film, and part of the reason it took so long is because I had a very wide view when I started about who would be possible to be included in this race to save the world. And I thought I would follow scientists and journalists and, you know, people who had written books on the subject, and as well as, you know, activists in the field, so to speak. And as time went on, I realized that people who were coming up with alternative energy solutions, if it worked, they would make a fortune. So I couldn't tell if they were in it, you know, for the saving the world, or if they were in it to make a fortune. So I decided I wasn't going to include those folks. And then the people who were, you know, journalists and writers of books and professors and whatnot, they were sort of earning their living fighting climate change. They had a kind of guaranteed living in a way that the people I follow do not. Mm-hmm. And so I've decided that the most interesting characters to me, the most interesting subjects to me, were people who, you know, weren't well off, weren't well connected, were just pretty ordinary folks who, unlike the rest of us, cannot tune this out and sort of have no choice but to jump in the trenches and do whatever they can to turn this around and have a passion and a inability to sort of tune, you know, an ability to do anything but keep at it until and unless we can make the changes needed to create a livable future.
Mm-hmm. So you were jumping kind of into the trenches with these activists. I mean, because it looked like some of the footage was shot by you and maybe some of the footage was shot by the subjects themselves. Is that right?
Not by the subjects themselves, oh, okay. But there were times, this is the first film of mine where I've accepted to use footage by people who were there around those protests, and they got a different angle or a closer view. And sometimes the footage is not, you know, super, you know, well produced in some mm-hmm. sense, but it captures the feeling of the protest in a way that maybe my perspective did not. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I included that.
I like that because it felt like you're really, you know, in the fire with these people. You're really on the front lines and you're seeing as close of a view as you possibly can of it. Like footage like Michael, when he's, were you there? Who was filming him as he was? I mean, maybe you're not even allowed to tell me, but as he's like cutting the chain.
I'm definitely allowed to tell you. As Michael's cutting the chain with the Keystone Pipeline, he brought a camera person with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that person who is the documentary filmmaker in her own right, she was also charged.
Okay.
Originally, but they dropped charges with her because they felt that she was a credible journalist.
Uh-huh.
And he was originally charged with 81 years in prison originally.
Yeah.
And then they reduced it. But he took quite a risk because he did it in North Dakota, which is a very conservative state. And so he chose to do it in that state.
I found the footage of the kayaktivists very compelling as well. As you are with these activists with the protest, how did you see your own role there? Did you consider yourself more of a journalist, or were you there as an activist as well? How did you balance that?
Well, I call my style of filmmaking life in progress. And so once I choose my subjects, I like to fade in the background and not influence what they do at all. In fact, to the extent that is possible, I like them to be able to completely ignore me and my small crew.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to achieve that, I'm committed to come many times and film when I know or suspect that a number of those times that I'm filming will not wind up in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So that ends up being expensive and difficult, especially when, like in this film, I'm filming in different cities, but I commit to being around a lot so that they can go about their lives and sort of ignore us. And so we were there for the big moments, like the protests, the arrests, the court cases, but I also want to be there for the nuanced moments, the moments where, you know, they're with their family. And yeah. I think the people in with their relationships, they're defined through their relationships, and you get to tell a lot about them. And I also feel that, especially in issues like this, where which are controversial, by making it sort of about the subjects and making this a intimate portrait and authentic portrait of the subjects, the viewer comes in and starts to connect with the subject and then gets drawn into the issue. Because so many people, they'll look at a documentary and they say, oh, I don't like that perspective, I'm not going to watch it. But if they watch enough to just get into these people and their lives, and these folks are not perfect. I don't make them out to be perfect. I show that they are, you know, like the rest of us, they have issues, and you know, they've kind of put their careers at risk by doing this, and some of them have put their families at risk.
Yeah.
And their families, you know, completely disagree with what they're doing. And so I show all that, and I think that makes them relatable.
Yeah, I mean, the most I found myself personally most invested in feeling for Aji and Adonis, and them being so young and having so much hatred against them, and they're just kids, and you can tell that their mother was very protective over them. What were the conversations that you had with that family and with their mom in order for them to give you their trust to film them in these such personal moments?
Well, I don't know that I have big conversations. I don't want to feel like I'm talking people into something. I do have a body of work that people can see. I've done subjects before that are very intimate, and they can look at the way I deal with those subjects. What I try to do is just show them that I'm there to show their point of view, and I'm going to fade into the background. I'm not going to try to influence what they do. And in time, when they see that, then they trust that I'm really trying to capture who they are and show their experience. Mm-hmm. And so by the time something, you know, big happens, or even in the nuanced smaller moments, they're comfortable to be themselves, and that's my goal.
Yeah, especially the moment where I think it's Adonis, his mother comes to pick him up, and he's not there. And then there's, you know, the fear of what happened to him. And then when they go downstairs, you know, it seems like they're going to have a private discussion. And you think, and I was thinking, okay, he's not going to follow them down there. But the next shot, you're actually there. Do you kind of, yeah? Do you? I guess you said you creep into the background. Is that something that you just kind of maneuvered your way to get that conversation, or how did that unfold for you?
Well, when I say casting is the most important thing. So I ask people if I can just be a part of what goes on. Now, I've had many times over the years where people say, I don't want you to film this. And then I don't film that.
Yeah.
But you hope that you can film that.
Yeah.
You hope that you can be a part of those moments, because, you know, that's not a moment that is exactly about climate change or the environment. It's about their relationship with each other. This family has a single mom who works, and she has two young boys, and they had to take the bus everywhere they went often because she had to work. And, you know, she was in Seattle, there's ferries, and he was coming back from a ferry where he was doing a camp on the other side, and she was supposed to pick him up. He wasn't there, but he actually got off, didn't see her. And because he was so used to getting home on his own, he just took the bus.
Yeah.
And she was sure that he didn't get off, and she called 911. It turned into this huge thing. But, you know, we followed them downstairs. And had they said to us, you know, this is private, we wouldn't have stayed there. But they let us stay there. You can tell that, you know, this isn't a moment I expected, because there was so little light there that it was very hard to get an image. And I didn't certainly want to turn on the light and change the environment from what they were comfortable in. So, you know, you make compromises and you hope that they're comfortable with it. And I think that's a wonderful family. I really felt very close to that family. I think they're just amazing. She's brought them up from when they were very young to be part of protesting things that they all believe in, and they're very tight, mm-hmm. warm family.
When what was the year? When were you following them? When were you filming that footage?
Well, Aji was, I think, 15 then, and I think he's 20 now.
Okay.
So,
because I imagine over the past year they've been pretty active. I'm hoping could you give us a little update about how they're doing right now?
You mean since the film?
Yeah, since the film.
Well, since we stopped filming, I don't want to give away what goes on when we're filming, mm-hmm. Because that story is poignant. But Aji decided not to go to college, and he is installing solar panels for a living.
Okay.
And his brother, his brother has grown up. He's taller than him now. Taller than Aji now. So he was a little kid when we started. The first scene is them playing chess.
Yeah. You know, yeah. So. The march across the United States, how much did you follow them on that march, and how did you keep up with them?
So on that march, they advertised that there was going to be 2,000 people on the march from every state in the union, and they were going to walk across the country and talk to people about climate change along the way. When the march started, there was 50 people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Only 50. And when it ended, there was 35.
Okay.
When you see them come into Washington, D.C., there's more than 35, but that's because for the last day, they invited local people to come do the last leg with them. So we filmed them, I think, 5 times along the way, and spent a couple of days with them each time. And I ended up embedding someone who was a college student to film while I wasn't there. And so we got some footage that way as well.
Oh, okay. And the kind of going back to the your role in filming these events, did you yourself face any potential legal threats as you're involved in these? Did that ever become a caution for you?
Well, it was a danger at time, but I never felt tremendously at risk. I mean, I feel like I'm a very serious looking documentary crew. I always have 2 cameras and a sound person with me. And so I feel like if it does come to that, we would tell them that we were journalists and we look like journalists. And I always tell my crew that if anything happens, you know, I will be responsible and I'll bail them out. I think the bigger threat was with the activists themselves, mm-hmm. because the way these groups work, especially the ones that are risking arrest, they work not with a hierarchy, but with kind of a unity, and every decision is made sort of unanimously. So I had the trust of my folks who were the primary subjects, but I would show up to a protest and I pretty much had to, at that moment, get the permission of the whole group. Mm. And there was a few people who looked at me as, you know, this guy's older, this guy's from LA, this guy has a very professional looking crew. And all of those were like, something about that, I don't know. So that was a bit of a problem. And so I remember I flew to film in Washington, D.C. And there was a whole group of, I don't know, 60, 80, 100 people that were that were talking about it the day before. And they asked them to, you know, give me permission to film the next day. And one person said, I don't like this guy. No, I don't think so. I don't think this is a good idea. And in theory, it has to be unanimous. But I think this one person had a reputation in the group as being someone who is like always against everything. And so they didn't, in this instance, go along with his suggestion. And I got you know, very important footage when they protested at FERC the next day, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But on another trip, I went up to, I think it's called Anacortes, Washington, where there's a power plant, a huge power plant. There was a protest there. And I was following a woman that didn't get into the film, perhaps partly because of this. And she was 90.
Oh.
And she would chain herself in her rocking chair to places that she wasn't supposed to be and get arrested. And she'd gotten arrested 12 times.
Wow.
And I had followed her, but I had mainly done interviews to that point, and I hadn't filmed her in any of the protests. And I had talked to her, and she was going to protest this oil train, and she was going to be there. And she gave me permission. She was part of a group of grannies, and they all gave me permission. And I went up there. But the people from the group, the larger climate organization of the protesters, they were the people I had to call when I got up there. And somehow I got my crew up there, and we came from the airport, and we were ready to film, and they wouldn't tell me where she was. I said, what are you talking about? We've talked. Yeah, I talked to you before I came up here. I have the permission of all these grannies. And she said, we've been told that you will film people besides them. You won't just film them. I said, I assure you, I will not film anyone but them unless they want to be filmed. And I will ask everyone's permission and only film people who give me permission. But she, for whatever reason, continued to refuse to give me the whereabouts of these grannies, and I never was able to film it.
Oh, okay.
And that was quite a investment. I raised all the money for these films myself through tax-deductible donations through the International Documentary Association, which is my 501c3 fiscal donor. Mm-hmm. And so it takes a long time to raise the money for a trip where you get everyone up to Washington and film. You know, so, I mean, we filmed a couple other things that were going on that weekend, but that was a big disappointment.
Yeah, I can imagine that being so. The courtroom scenes, how did you gain access to those courtrooms? Did you have any issues of trying to get cameras in there?
Yes, it is. You have to be very persistent to get permission. And, of course, with a court case, you can be, 2 days out from a court case, and they can postpone it a week or two.
Yeah.
And you've already bought your tickets. So I did not have that problem. With the court case that was with Abby and near Seattle, they gave me permission, and they were very open to me filming. And what I ended up doing was bringing my two cameramen, but I brought four cameras.
Mm-hmm.
So each camera guy had two cameras with him, so he could film two things. And so it was like having four cameras in a courtroom. And then I brought this very experienced sound person, and he set up nine different microphones in the courtroom. And we were there for a full week, 5 days of shooting. And so we had this great coverage. On the other hand, you have conservative North Dakota, and they were like not wanting me to film, period. And grudgingly saying, you can bring in one camera, and if you bring in a sound person, that sound person is not allowed to mic anybody and has to sit back in the gallery, you know, with everybody else. So, you know, and you can see the difference between the filming in the two instances.
Yeah.
But you know, in the end, you know, we got what we needed in terms of telling the story, so it worked out.
Mm-hmm. That moment when Abby is on the stand and she's kind of locking up, and then they take the recess. It felt like there's a lot of tension in that courtroom. Can you describe the feeling in those courtrooms?
Well, yeah, there's certainly a lot of tension,
mm-hmm.
and Abby's a unique person because she wants to do a perfect job. Her husband says, I don't think this got into the film, but her husband talks about her bringing, she doesn't bring a briefcase of materials with her every day. She brings this rolling cart, which she has under the table, and has all her notes of everything. Well, in a courtroom, you don't get to refer to your notes. Yeah. What's she going to bring that rolling card up to the witness stand with her? But she brought it every day. It was right next to her in case she needed to refer to anything. And she wanted so bad to tell everything that was on her mind and convince the jury that this was important to stop the oil trains going through their state. Mm-hmm. And she wanted it so, so bad that when she got on the witness stand, she kind of froze up. And then she went back and she talked to her lawyer, and we weren't, that's an example of something we weren't able to go film. Yeah. I didn't even try. I knew that that would not be appropriate. They had a conversation between the two of them. And, but we could hear that because she was mic'd. And then she came back, and I think she did an excellent job.
Yeah, it was just, she knocked it out of the park. That was just, it felt like such a victory in that moment.
Yeah, I think so too. She'll be glad to hear you thought that too.
So as we start to kind of ease into the end of the conversation here, thank you again for giving me your time. Where has this film taken you? You mentioned the email that you were on a panel for Extinction Rebellion. Was that for your role in this film, or is that something that you were doing personally?
Well, so we are making the film available for virtual screening with climate organizations, and Extinction Rebellion is a great organization. It believes in getting people into the streets, making their voices heard for a livable future. And they use costumes, they use music, they use art. And so we were very glad when they wanted to do a screening with us, followed by a panel discussion. And so we're doing that with a number of climate organizations. Mm-hmm. And afterwards on the panel, we had three of our people from the film and three activists from England, because we released the film both in England and the United States, and that group was in England.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything you'd like to, any events that you would like to let our listeners know about, or any specific organizations that you think most need their help right now?
Well, when people want to get a ticket to the film, they can go through their local theater. Mm-hmm. And they can also go through some of these climate organizations as well. And if they want to find the climate organizations, maybe I won't say that because you're a theater.
Well, either way, yeah.
It's our website, www.theracetosavetheworld.com. But the message that I want to say is that, you know, there is a limited amount of time, a limited window of time we have to deal with climate change before it literally becomes too late. And, you know, there's the people in this film, they believe, and I agree, that the antidote to feeling depressed about climate change is to get in this movement, take action, get in the streets, make your voice heard. And, you know, Bill says, when he's on the couch with his daughter and she says, change is inevitable. She's 16 at the time. She says, change is inevitable. You know, I don't want to fear the future. You know, change is inevitable. And he says, yeah, change is inevitable. But are we going to be the authors of that change or the victims of that change? And that's a decision that we need to make. And I think especially younger people who are going to have to live with the effects of climate change throughout their lives, we need to get into the streets, make our voices heard, and demand the type of profound change that needs to happen in the time frame we have to turn this around. And we need to make that change in order to convince the politicians that are now, you know, in the pockets of the fossil fuel industry that they have no choice but to cooperate with the people and help fight climate change so we can make this world livable for our children, grandchildren, and future generations.
Of course. Thank you so much for making this film and for being an activist and doing everything that you do.
Well, thank you for the interview, and you have a beautiful theater. I'm just so impressed.
Thank you so much. Yeah, if you ever make it back to Ann Arbor for some time, we'd love to show you around.
Okay, I imagine I'll be there one day.
It would be an honor to have you by sometime.
Well, thank you, Nick. It was nice meeting you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Joe, for giving me your time.
Good talking with you.
It was great talking with you as well. Have a great day. That was Joe Gantz with some inspiring words to take to heart there at the end. I thank him once again for his time. If you want to see his film, The Race to Save the World, visit michigantheater.org/virtual, and the poster for the film will be there at the top. Not only will your rental support Joe's film and his causes, but half the proceeds will also benefit the Michigan and State Theater. Thank you all for listening. Though this interview was private, we'll be sure to have some more live Q&As over social media again very soon. To stay up to date on all future announcements, be sure to follow the Michigan and State Theater on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find us at Michigan Theater and at State Theater A2. Of course, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and give us a rating so that we may catch the ears of more listeners. Thank you to Matt Gauntlet and the Ann Arbor District Library for making sure these episodes drop on a timely basis. To email the show with topic suggestions or to send us your movie magic moments, comments, or even let us know if you want to be on the show, you can reach us at btmpod@gmail.com. And the new theme you're listening to right now is Keith Manfield's Morning Broadway, a classic library music tune. We'll be back with another episode next Monday. Thank you for listening and joining us behind the marquee.